being. Your silence is commanding.
Please be seated. We'll call the third case for today, 03AP2245, Daniel Steinbeck v. Green Lake Sanitary District. According to our notes, Mr. Sorensen, Steve Sorensen, will argue for 10 minutes on behalf of Daniel Steinbeck. Attorney Kent A. Tesmantner will argue for 15 minutes on behalf of Mr. Steinbeck et al. And Mr. O'Connor will argue on behalf of the Green Lake Sanitary District, and Attorney Sorensen will do 5 minutes in rebuttal. Is that your understanding?
Fine.
All right. Attorney Sorensen, representing Daniel Steinbeck et al. You may proceed.
May it please the Court, Justice Abramson, Justice Wilcox, Justice Bradley, Justice Crooks, Justice Foster, Justice Robinsack, Justice Butler, I respectfully represent that here I am today to address an issue which I believe is of the utmost importance to the citizens of the state of Wisconsin. I am joined today with co-counsel Ken Tesmantner. Together we intend to provide you with the insight, the background, and the appropriate law to be applied to this very unique but significant fact situation. We intend to provide you with the material to answer the question how special assessments against condo owners should be handled, specifically in light of this fact situation in this case. In this case, the petitioners, the plaintiffs in this case, are owners of condominium units within a single structure, which was created in 1985 in the town of Green Lake, Green Lake County, Wisconsin. The respondent in this case is a sanitary district under organized under the laws of the state of Wisconsin, comprised within the towns of Green Lake and portions of the town of Brooklyn, Princeton, all within Green Lake County. But the key to understanding this case is to recognize, number one, that this property was created well before the sewering issue came before us. The other key that I think is probably germane is that we're dealing with one building, one unit, one structure, which currently houses 18 separate apartment-type units, which are marketed and sold as units within a single condominium building.
Counsel, would your arguments be any different if the condominium complex was two buildings of nine each?
Yes.
So it's fundamental to your argument that it only be, that they be a single structure and adjoining in some way. Is that correct?
That's not correct. I'm sorry. Okay. Let me clarify. What I think the key consideration is to take a look at the uniqueness of the specific property and how it's being serviced. In this case, we have a single building that's being serviced by a single lateral on a single lot. You could have a condominium project that's on two separate lots serviced by two separate laterals that had two separate buildings or structures or serviced that in that manner. If that be the case, my answer, Justice Bradley, would be different than the answer and the facts that I'm presenting to you today.
And similarly, if it was one lot but a condo complex of two buildings on this one lot, four units each, it would be different. Hmm?
That would be a correct statement.
Yeah. Well, you'd one or two laterals for those two buildings.
Well, you need, I think he's saying you need two.
Well, I want him to say that.
Justice?
You want one or two laterals if you have two buildings on one lot.
Again, Chief Justice, you have to look at the unique set of the structure.
Okay, but let's just say there's only one lateral, two lots, two buildings.
Then I would think there would be one availability charge, because you're bringing one lateral into the property.
It's the number of laterals that governs. The number of laterals makes the difference to you.
In this situation, I think that's correct, because you need look at the unique character of this property in this situation. Let me just compare it.
Let me just ask
yes,
you
sir.
On the lateral. As I look through all of the briefs, there was nobody else that was paying differently. The only exception is the condo with one lateral. Then you have the individual taxation or the key parcels. They're paying differently. Nobody else in the people with the mobile park are paying one lateral. The people with the Pilgrim Camp. Right. That's one lateral. Chief, what you're saying is that, chiefly what you're saying is that one lateral should mean one expense. Is that
correct? If the mechanics of the operation allow for, in this unique fact situation, allow for one availability charge, on the cost-benefit analysis, which assessments are to be based upon, if that makes sense, then that's what the charge should be. Because the whole concept of the ordinance, or for the resolution in this case, and the concept of sewer assessment is to try to relate the benefit conveyed to the charge imposed and the costs related. One of the things that was suggested was this is an 18-unit building and that the district could provide 18 separate laterals. The concept of having a lateral up in the sky reaching a second-story unit is a ludicrous.
Doesn't the second-story benefit from this lateral, this single lateral?
Yes.
You've got 18 owners, right?
That's correct.
And each of them benefits from this single lateral.
That's correct.
And you want them to share the expense of one lateral, not be socked with the cost, each one with the cost of the lateral.
It doesn't exist. I mean, they should pay for what is necessary to service the property. Cost-benefit analysis, and I think the ordinance allows for that.
I have a question for you. You had an amicus. There was an amicus brief filed by the Wisconsin Realtors. And
yes.
My understanding of the brief is the bottom line is they agree with you.
That's correct.
But you don't agree with them.
We clarified their position.
Yeah, tell me about it. Okay.
All right. That's what we do all the time, motions for reconsideration.
Tell me where you differ, where their position and yours demands clarification. I just want to be sure I understand why you don't accept all the help you can get.
We certainly accept all the help we can get, but what I think the difference is they didn't relate to the unique fact situation of this case, something that I've lived with.
I don't see what's so unique. This could just as well be an apartment house, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And if it were an apartment house, there'd be one charge to the owner.
There'd be one availability charge, correct.
Right, because that owner benefited.
That's correct.
All right. The only difference between an apartment house and this is the type of ownership.
That's correct.
And the ownership here is by the individual, for lack of a better word, quote, tenants of this apartment unit.
That's correct.
So each of them is an owner.
That's correct.
And the district is saying each of them is an owner. That's what the condominium law says, each of them is an owner. And therefore, each of them benefits. Therefore, each of them should be charged, even though there's one lateral. And I thought the difference you had with the Wisconsin Realtors Association is the association doesn't really view the condominium owners as owners of the property, and you do. And that's why they have assessments.
Right. One of the things that they...
That is for tax purposes.
Yes.
Right?
I mean, they talk about for tax purposes, and one of the things they did is they made a leap, and I'd like to take you to that leap because I think it's very important. And here's how I'd like to point that out. For example, if there had been a construction project that involved the building, the contractor would have put a construction lien on the property. The building, lot number one, in this case certified lot number 1401, he would have then, or she would have, depending on the sex of the construction contractor, would have enforced that lien against the 18 individual property owners through the condominium association. That's really what I'm saying to you here today, and I think that's what the Wisconsin Realtors is suggesting, is that there is an association which manages and operates the facility that provides a mechanism, and under our legal system, provides a mechanism to collect on liens, to collect on assessments. So to say that there is no system is to belie the existence of actual law today. And I think that clarifies what the Wisconsin realtors were trying to say in their brief towards the court. I don't think they drew back to the facts as much as we would have. But you'll notice that we do concur that, indeed, in this situation, what we're dealing with is actually a single building with 18 apartment-type units. The other thing I'd like to clarify...
Justice. Before you go any further,
yes, sir.
Let me ask you this, since we're talking about the realtor's brief, the amicus brief.
Yes, sir.
Do you agree with them that to go the way that has been gone by the Court of Appeals would be discriminatory against condominium owners? That's certainly part of their argument.
Right. And I'm saying, what I'm saying is there is a way of keeping this resolution in place and still not find it to be discriminatory. And I point that out, Justice Crooks, in the formula that was used to deal with the individual 55 lots with the 55 permanent trailers on them, which was right across the street. You notice that those are permanent structures on it, that the court recognized and the circuit court recognized as such.
You may finish the thought.
That the court recognized as such when it made its ruling saying we're dealing with 55 separate permanent trailer homes. In this case, their charge, one availability charge, is not it discriminatory to walk across the street and say because you chose a condominium form of ownership instead of a cooperative form of ownership, you therefore must pay 18 times, where if you pulled that same logic across and you said, okay, you have a separate residential unit within this park, therefore there should have been 55 charges. And we're not advocating that there should be. Again, we go back to the ordinance and how the ordinance suggests if you have a multiple unit facility, you can go to the Wisconsin Administrative Code, you can use the affluent standard and deal with the connection charge if you wish. Or you can do as the district did and simply say, we'll charge one availability charge and we'll charge, in the case of the mobile homes, we'll charge 55, or in our case, we would suggest 18.
The difference the district points out is that it's taxed. I'm talking about the condos are taxed as a separate parcel. And that's their, in other words, it's how it's taxed.
Correct.
That's what they're basing their argument on.
Correct. And we recognize that, Justice Wilcox, that that is an issue that needs to be dealt with, that you have to have a system where you can take a building where there are 18 separate owners and tax that building. But I give you the example, if I may.
Well, I think you will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. So
thank you.
Cut it now. Mr. Tesmantner.
Thank you very much. Compliment you on the new podium, by the way. It has more room. I wanted to key in on a couple legal arguments, but I also would like to just make sure we're clear with Justice Bradley's initial question. I think your hypothetical about whether there have been two buildings with 9 units in it is answered by how the district treated Pilgrim Center Camp. Pilgrim Center Camp had... if I'm not mistaken, it had one one availability assessment. It ended up getting 12 connection assessments because there were 12 buildings on it that were going to be generating effluent. No different from the situation we have, where we've got one building and 18 units that will be creating effluent. What I want to emphasize to this court, and what Attorney Sorensen was getting to, I believe, is that what we are arguing here is we're not asking this court, nor were we asking the Court of Appeals, nor were we asking the trial court to strike down the regulation that was used. We instead are arguing that it can be applied and it should be applied differently from how it was applied. And I'm, of course, referring to Resolution 9309, which is in the appendices that you have. It says that they can assess an availability charge against the lot of record or a parcel of record as recorded in the office of the Green Lake County Register of Deeds. And you notice we got into some semantical things in the briefs. My argument here, and again, this is with Peterson and all the progeny about reasonableness, is that when you have an ordinance that can be applied one of two ways, you have to take the approach that has the most reasonable result. That's what's dictated by all of the decisions of this court, all of the decisions of the Court of Appeals.
Counsel, would you say that again? You said, I think, you have to take the result that is the most reasonable?
You have to apply this ordinance or regulation, I should say, to come up with the most reasonable result.
Then how do you deal with the presumptions in this area of the law? And I take a look at the LaBelle case just because I have it in front of me.
Certainly, I have it in front of me as well.
And I'm reading from 280 to 281, because the presumptions and the tests, if you will, kind of meld into the standard of review. And as I think they do when I set out in my mind the steps, and apparently they did in this opinion also. So the law presumes that the municipality proceeded reasonably in making the assessment, is one presumption, and the police power of a municipality is broad, and in general the courts may intercede only when the exercise of that power is clearly unreasonable, and that's cited other places. This cites CIT Group, the LaBelle. Now, that is very different than what I just heard you say.
No, if it is, I misspoke.
Okay, let me tell you why I think it's different, and then clarify my misunderstanding, if
certainly
you will.
Certainly, we'll try to.
I thought I heard you say that it has to be the most reasonable, and it seems to me that this review indicates the police power of a municipality is broad, and in general the courts may intercede only when the exercise of that power is clearly unreasonable. I hear a difference. Do you?
I do, and what I meant to say is that this, the way they did apply their regulation, is clearly unreasonable.
So there can be many reasonable ways, and it doesn't have to be the most reasonable, but as long as it's not clearly unreasonable. Is that correct?
I agree, although there are cases that in addition say to that one of the ways of testing whether it's clearly unreasonable is not only the results, but whether there was a reasonable way to do it.
Yes, that's right. That's how you define reasonableness.
That may be where I'm getting confused.
I see it, as I pointed out, a big difference between they have to be choose the most reasonable, as opposed to what I understand the law is, they just can't choose something that's clearly unreasonable.
Sure.
Okay. And let me explain your argument. As you know, we talk about costs and benefits.
Yes.
Obviously, there's a benefit. I mean, you argue that they had a septic system that was in place, but let's say we discard that. We just talk about costs.
Yes.
The key to your argument is that the cost of the district and the effluent that's coming out basically is the same, except in your case, because one lateral plus a hookup charge was applied to everybody else except your situation.
That's correct.
And so from a cost standpoint, the district figured out how much it's going to cost, and they said $4,730, and then the hookup was, the connection fee was $59 or whatever it was. But the argument you're making is that, look, under the cost analysis and whether it was unreasonable, that you were treated differently from everybody else. And that is that's the thrust, I think, of your argument.
It is, Your Honor. We're claiming that the district made an $80,410 windfall by the way they assessed the availability charges. And let me address that, because that goes to the clearly unreasonable standard, I believe.
Counsel, before you do that, is there any place in the record that tells us what the cost was for this project and running all these laterals?
Perhaps Mr. Sorensen would be better off on answering that because he was trial counsel. I didn't see it, but I also didn't see it argued. So I believe it probably is in the proceedings, but I don't know where to tell you to look.
Okay. Thank you.
Before you go yes. into another argument, let me ask you about something that gives me some concern. One of the cases that both of you talk about is the Village of Egg Harbor versus Mariner Group case.
Yes.
That strikes me as a case that at least on the surface looks like it's very similar to the situation we're dealing with here. How do you distinguish that case?
On the surface it does. It absolutely has no application to this case whatsoever.
Why is that?
Because it hinges around ILHR 83.15, which is a connection charge. It's not an availability charge case. It's no different from what happened in this case. In this case, they decided that residential usages would have a connection charge of, what was it, $5,300 or something like that, $5,600?
$5,930, I think. Is
it? And we're assuming, we didn't put into the briefs, but commercial might have higher and that sort of thing. That's what was at issue in Egg Harbor. If you go and look at ILHR 8315, it's the connectivity or connection charge, not availability. Petitioners did challenge the connection at trial as well. They abandoned that on appeal. So we're really just focusing on availability. So Egg Harbor has no application in this case whatsoever.
Thank you.
The legal standard of reasonableness is a question of law which we review de novo?
Yes. You know, I knew that somehow or another we'd come around to Wassenaar versus panels, which I always do when I'm up here. But yes.
That case.
Pardon me?
You like that case?
I do.
Okay.
What we have there, we've got this mixed standard, really. What you just read is in one of the cases that says it's de novo.
It's LaBelle.
LaBelle. Mm-hmm. And then we also have the case law that says that there are findings of fact made by the trial court that they are supposed to be looked at under the clearly erroneous standard.
Mark LaBelle says that, too.
And then we have the line of cases that says that reasonableness is intertwined with factual findings, so it's not clearly de novo. So it's an area that's a little bit confusing, but I don't look at it as being a whole lot different from most of the cases where reasonableness is the standard. I bring up Wassenaar versus Panos because I was up here in January arguing on a post-divorce maintenance modification case, and the reasonableness standard was there, too. So what I wanted to point out to the court is this. The City of Milwaukee versus Milwaukee and Suburban Transport Company case, which is 9 West 2nd, it's actually cited in the Wisconsin Realtors Association brief and not ours. It is interesting in that it says that cities, this is a city assessment, cities should not be permitted under the guise of regulatory power to collect revenue for the benefit of the city, regardless of the amount necessary to defray the expense of its regulation. Now, I understand we're dealing with a police power case here. That doesn't have to be a dollar for dollar, and you don't have to prove that the property was benefited in the amount there. But one of the things I just wanted to point out to the court is, if we look at the case law, the Gelhaus case, G-E-L-H-A-U-S, is cited by everybody in their briefs on this case. Gelhaus case was a case where the city gave a 25% reduction regarding the sidewalk curb and gutter costs when it came up with its assessment. It gave a 40% reduction for street resurfacing. The case of Berkvam, B-E-R-K-V-A-M, versus City of Glendale, which is cited in the briefs, was a case where this court remanded, felt that summary judgment was inappropriate in that case because they needed to find out whether the property was benefited. But I raise it for this purpose. The case cites that the front foot cost to the city, again, same type of assessments, curbs and gutters and that sort of thing, was $36 per front foot, and they were assessing only $10 of that. I'm not arguing that you can't assess the full amount, but I am going to argue that it didn't cost $85,140 to run a lateral to the lot line. Now, while we're on the subject of lot line, that's...
What case were you just referring to? I'm sorry, I didn't...
Certainly. It was, the case is Berkvam, B-E-R-K-V-A-M, versus City of Glendale.
And was that an availability assessment?
It had nothing to do with sewers. It was curbs, sidewalks, and that sort of thing. But it does have to do with the police powers and reasonableness. And it also focused on the benefit in that case.
I'm a little lost because I understood your distinction of why the Mariner Group, the Egg Harbor case, had no applicability was because it was a connection charge, not an availability charge.
Correct.
And so I understood that to be that we should only be focusing on availability charge cases, and yet that's not what you're doing.
Well, that's correct. And if you look at all the cases that were cited to this court, it's difficult to
find a lot of availability.
It is.
Yeah, that's right. So is there any other distinction with regard to the Village of Egg Harbor other than the different charge?
There is.
The discussion regarding the police powers I assume that's applicable regardless of the charge and the standards of review and the presumptions, all of that language is applicable regardless of the fact that it is a connection charge and not an availability charge. Am I right or wrong?
Well, you're right as far as saying that the standards are things we can take from and look at how it was applied. I think there's several differences, and I pointed out some of them in our brief. One is that they were talking about how they used the method they used because it was a resort community with some properties that are seasonal and some are year-round commercial businesses. Some are part-time summer residences, and they were talking about the difficulty of figuring this out. Now, again, that goes to connection, you understand, to usage, not to availability. I don't know that we have one lump sum in our case at availability plus 18 connection assessments based on use. Here they used one lump sum base unit plus an additional assessment based on use. That would be one way to analyze it, but the facts are different, and I think that's what Mr. Sorensen was talking about how the facts are somewhat specific to this case. I guess what I would like this court to focus on is there's three prongs that are in all these cases. Mm-hmm. Is the whether there was a reasonable basis on this and. One of the things that Locke Lavelle talks about is mere uniformity does not automatically equal reasonable results. We, of course, focus on the Peterson case, which talks about disparate treatment, and I think that's what we have here to the point that the Wisconsin Realtors Association even surmised it might rise to the level of an equal protection problem.
Counsel, I guess I'm looking at this a little bit differently than you are, but I was kind of curious as to why you weren't arguing for uniformity from the standpoint that, look, you've got one lateral that's laid. It costs the same to lay that lateral when it's leading to a property line as it costs to lay another lateral. So if the cost is the same to lay it, why aren't you charging the same cost?
Well, and again, maybe not express myself too well, but I am trying to argue that. When I started off my argument, you notice I talked about how this regulation can be applied to a parcel of record or to a lot of record. And what I'm suggesting is that gives the district the flexibility to look property by property and say, are we going to assess this property as a parcel or are we going to assess this parcel as a lot? When it comes to condominium, it's our belief that they should assess it as a lot. And instead of relying on this tax assessor's fiction of having a tax key number. One of the things that I want to point out that backs up that application is if you try to take resolution 93.09 and apply it the way the district wants it applied, it makes no sense. If you look at Roman numeral 3.
Counsel?
Yes.
The red light's on, so please sum.
Okay. I simply point out it talks about bringing laterals to the lot line. And there's no lot line for a condominium unit, so you can't even follow the availability regulation.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. O'Connor, representing the district.
Chief Justice, members of the court, I appreciate the opportunity to speak this afternoon on behalf of the Green Lake Sanitary District. And I want to start out quickly by just reviewing the nature of the district's policy for publishing, for financing these public sewers. Before 1993, the Green Lake Sanitary District had a trash recycling program and a recycling program, but they didn't operate a sanitary sewer system. Everything about this public sewer system was developed in the early 90s, first deciding to install a public system of sewers, determining which portions of the district would be suitable to provide public sewers to, identifying a location where a wastewater treatment plant could be built and the whole permitting process associated with that, and then a plan of financing for the various components of this. The district recognized that it was a challenge to find a reasonable way to allocate the costs of all of those components of this system. Some areas of the district would be served by public sewers, others wouldn't. The district required that septic and holding tanks in the unsewered areas be regularly pumped and the wastewater treated at the district's plant. Taking these things into account, the commissioners developed a balanced program in which the district levied ad valorem taxes to finance the treatment plant itself, user charges on a quarterly basis to cover the actual costs of the system's operation, and then elected to use special assessments to finance the sewer collection and transportation system. The district is overwhelmingly residential. There are a handful of non-residential uses, some institutional, some commercial, but within the residential class of users, which is by far the majority, there's a tremendous variety. There are lakeshore mansions with large frontages on Big Green Lake worth millions of dollars. There are small pre-war subdivisions that are improved with modest cottages. And there are deluxe waterfront residential condominiums.
Well, isn't the one thing that runs throughout all of this that people that have one lateral pay for one lateral except the condo? I mean, all the... I'm familiar with Green Lake also, and
there's been a lot of attention.
This is a special assessment, and the one lateral theory that your opponent is putting out here, under that theory, if you use that as a cost, that would be consistent. One lateral, everyone pays $47.30 for it. It has one lateral.
I appreciate
if you have more than one lateral, you should pay more.
I appreciate, Justice Wilcox, that you attribute that one lateral theory to my
I don't know who, because that
is not the theory of the district special assessment policy. I want to point out something that's
Wait a minute, Counsel. That was my question to you, is that we're talking about reasonable costs, and you said special assessment. I'm asking one lateral. Everyone paid for one lateral. Isn't that how you came up with a cost?
Each parcel was assessed a $4,300 special assessment because public sewers were made available to that parcel, whether or not
it had one lateral or not.
Whether or not the parcel was even connected to the sewer. There's been a lot of discussion about lateral sewer lines. It may be helpful for me to clarify what a lateral sewer line is and what the availability assessment covers. A lateral line is a private pipe located on private land. It's not constructed by public expense through this special assessment. The district simply runs public sewer lines, normally within road rights of way, and as the road right, as the public sewer traverses the frontage of each parcel, it installs a connection point at which a lateral line constructed by the homeowner or property owner can be connected to that public sewer if the property is going to be connected. The district levied the availability assessment on each parcel whether or not it was connected to the sewer. At the time that the district proceeded with this, it advised each parcel owner that it had of where it, requesting that the parcel owner advise where it wished to have that lateral stub installed for the convenience of the property owner's project of installing the lateral line. When those letters were sent to the homeowners in the condominium association, their council responded by contacting the sanitary district and saying, well, we don't actually want to have a lateral for each of the condominium units. We understand that because there's a single building, you're only going to put in one lateral line.
This part
that
of the
correspondence is at tab 29 yeah. of the statement of proceedings. At that time, the district responded to counsel for the unit owners by saying that our engineers had understood that for the convenience of the association and to minimize their expense, that it would be better to have a single connection pipe rather than multiple connection pipes for each unit owner. And the district accommodated that, and the homeowners requested that. So the number of lateral lines is not the critical point in this. I think the critical point is whether it was reasonable for the district to take the fraction of the whole sewer cost that is covered under the special assessment for transportation of wastewater and make a portion of that identical regardless of the size or characteristics of the parcel. That's what they did here.
I want to back up to what you just said about the number of lateral lines. As I understand it, and you correct me if I'm wrong, what you've got is you've got a lateral that runs to each property, and then you have the various properties connecting to the main line. Is that correct?
You have the sewer main,
yes,
and then
main.
Individual properties connect via a lateral.
Via a lateral, they connect. All right.
Each property owner puts in their own lateral. What the district installs is a connection hub, which is referred to as a four-inch stub in the...
How many hubs were there on this property?
There was one connection hub at the request of the property owners.
Counselor, I want to talk to you a little bit about the district resolution that speaks to the assessment. And part of my question to opposing counsel had to do with what it costs to put in these stubs. And the reason I asked you that is that there are two parts to the assessment, one the connection charge and one the availability charge. The connection charge, according to your resolution, covers more things. It covers the cost of the infrastructure necessary for the transportation of sewage to the district's wastewater treatment plant and some other things that are listed. And that's Section 4 of the resolution. In Section 3, it talks about this availability assessment that we're here on today, and it says that this is to cover, quote, costs for the work to make sanitary sewer available to the property. To me, those seems like different costs, and that was the genesis for my question about, well, what are we allocating here, and what, you know, how did the district decide to come up with this $47.30? They must have had some dollar amount they were looking at.
I think it's an excellent question, Justice Rogan-Sack, and I concede that there is some overlap in the coverage of these two charges.
Uh-huh.
It's clear from the language of Section 3 that the availability assessment is not limited to the nominal cost of installing a connection stub in a sewer line.
Right, and that's why
it covers a much broader range of expenses, and of course the range of expenses is very substantial. There are engineering costs, blasting fees, land acquisition, easement acquisition, construction of lift station and pump stations. Each connected user relies on an entire system of improvements that extend from their unit to the treatment plant.
But should you separate the two out for me? Because I can see that the availability assessment is meant to cover more, a broader scope of things than is, I guess we're talking
the
about the connection covers more and the availability less. And since we're here on availability, it doesn't talk about, now you tell me.
The resolution uses relatively broad language.
Right.
to describe what is covered by the availability assessment, which includes the works and costs necessary to provide sewer service to the property. Each time an extension has been made by the sanitary district, they have received information from their engineers on the proper allocation of the costs involved in the project. In this case, overall, that came down with a recommendation that the district use effectively about 43% and 57%, the one for the availability, the other for the connection. The consequence of that is that owners of parcels that are not connected to the system mm-hmm. bear approximately 43% of the project expense. Mm-hmm. And those who have sewer available and also connect pay 100% of a pro rata share of the cost of getting the system installed.
Okay, so if I understand what you're saying to me, then if you don't get to charge each condominium owner $47.30, whatever that nugget of dollars that the district decided was the amount they were going to collect will be short.
The consequence would be that those costs would have to be shifted to the parcels of land to which the assessment could properly be made. It would effectively result in about a 95% discount to the homeowners in the condominium association, and that would have to be made up by the people who own the other cottages and parcels.
I'm sorry, I'm not expressing myself well. I understand that you're not collecting 100%, that you decided some percentage of it you're going to allocate to the property owners. My question to you is, of that number, we'll just call it X for lack of a better term for it. If you do not collect 18 times 4730 for this unit of property, then the district is going to be short by 17 units, actually, that they allocated out to cover this nut of money that they're going to charge back to the property. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. That's all I need to know. Thank you.
And as a consequence, the district would have to go through further proceedings in order to, in effect, levy an additional assessment against those parcels that the court may determine actually are subject to an availability assessment in order to recover that $78,000 or so.
Counsel,
we have one stub, and the condominium is going to put in the lateral if it wants to. On what basis do you assess the 18 units separately? But do we agree that if there was just one house, there would only be one assessment of $4,800?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So why do you then go to assess it at 18 times that? Because there's one building, but you have 18 owners.
Well, neither the assessment system that's been approved under the policy of the district nor the state law actually assesses taxes or special assessments on buildings. Special assessments and taxes are levied on parcels of real estate. The buildings and the common areas that constitute the Sunrise Resort and Yacht Club do not constitute real property. The only real property that exists at the Sunrise Condominium is the condominium units. I think the legislature has been completely unambiguous in stating in Section 70321 that after a condominium declaration has been filed, that no taxes or assessments may be made against any portion of the common elements or anything else. The only method for assessing taxes or assessments on property that's within a condominium is to levy those against the condominium units. So that's the way the district proceeded.
Counsel, I have another question for you. Just say these were timeshare condos, and instead of having 18 owners, you had 10 owners per unit, so now you got 180 owners. You're going to assess them 180 times 4730 rather than 18 times 4730?
Justin, I'll be perfectly honest and say I don't have any idea. I don't know anything about timeshare condominium ownership in Wisconsin.
Probably don't have a parcel number.
I don't think I could give you an answer.
They probably don't have a parcel number and are not taxed separately.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I simply don't know about timeshare condominiums. What I know about is that In this case, the district felt that whether this extensive tract of waterfront land with very valuable improvements on it had been divided into 18 lots and had 18 separate buildings built, or whether they elected to have a single building with extensive shared open space and marina facilities, that those real property parcels that were created by that process were very similar in their nature and wholly comparable with the other single-family residential parcels in the district, and that if no assessment had been made against each of those units, the practical consequence would have been to have shift costs to other property owners in the district who I think would have had a very legitimate claim, why should my modest cottage be paying so much when those grand condominiums are paying so little?
Does that make an argument when you're looking at Green Lake? You yourself mentioned the several mansions that are there. There are a lot of homes there. I think that if you're going to get into that argument, this is an extensive piece of land on the waterfront. Would it make any difference then if you had someone had a 200-foot, $3 million home, which I know many of them exist on Green Lake? Well, I might be underplaying it. I know they're probably worth more than that. But
probably more than that. But in any event, I think the Peterson court, I think, clearly signaled that using that front footage method was, I think the court said it was highly suspicious. And in that case, the court insisted on the use of something that we have done here, which is an effective unitary assessment.
But you were talking about the expanse, the fact that they owned this water frontage. I thought you were saying that if they had decided to split it up into 18 separate parcels, it would have obviously been treated differently. But here they had one lot, and they had 18 different owners. And they had it made the same sense.
Well, I mean, they had at one time one lot.
Right.
But when they elected to file their condominium declaration, mm-hmm. they chose to divide the property, not spatially, and I'm well aware that a condominium is not a subdivision, but they did determine to divide the interests in that property in a manner that made each of them separate interests in property.
Let's see if I understand this. The fact that the ownership is vertical in a condo, which I assume it is treated the same way as if the ownership was horizontal.
That's correct, Your Honor. It's irrelevant to the district how they elect to arrange their ownership interests at the point that they have established wholly independent interests, that are interests that include a real property interest upon which a single-family dwelling can be placed. The district regards that as, for all intents and purposes, a single-family parcel. And the district elected to treat all of those the same way. With respect to that,
O'Connor, your resolution, your client's resolution. I'm sorry, will you finish?
That's all right, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. All right, then after Justice, whoever you are. Justice Cross. Good, all right.
We should turn our tags around.
That's right. All right.
Yeah, I think it's my turn, so let me give this a shot. Mr. O'Connor, in looking at the Green Lake Sanitary District Resolution, which I think is 93-09, it defines lot as a lot of record or a parcel of record as recorded in the Office of the Register of Deeds. So you've got two different approaches. This, apparently, as I understand it, in the Office of the Register of Deeds, is recorded as Lot 1, Certified Survey Map 1401. So why should we get concerned about the fact that for tax purposes, each unit is also recorded as a parcel?
I'm ready to answer that.
Both approaches in the resolution.
The arguments made by the condominium owners put a lot of weight on the separate mention of lots and parcels in that section. The court will look carefully at that section. What it says is that a lot, which is defined later to be subject to an availability assessment, means a lot of record or a parcel of record as recorded in the Office of the Register of Deeds and listed as a separate tax parcel. They read that to say that if it is a parcel, then in that case, it needs to be recorded in the Office of the Register of Deeds and it needs to be a separate tax parcel. But if it's a lot, no such requirements apply. Here's what I think is comparable. Suppose that a school teacher announced that a class field trip would be open to any boy or girl who has completed all homework assignments and maintained a grade of B or better. Under their syntax, reading that sentence, all the boys get to go on a field trip. Only the girls need to meet the performance requirements of completing their homework and maintaining the grade average.
Seems fair to me.
I think that's unreasonable.
Well, it seems plain silly to me. And it's very difficult.
So does the girls handle it.
It's hard for me to understand why they feel that the commissioners of the sanitary district would make a distinction, would care whether, in the case of a parcel, it's recorded and a tax parcel has been assigned, but in the case of a so-called lot, it's not. The difference without a distinction. The reason the language is used in the ordinance, in the resolution, is because this is the common parlance. If people have lands that are still described as sections or quarter sections, they don't call them lots, they call them parcels. Whereas, as is quite common in Green Lake, the lands have been platted and a subdivision has been recorded with blocks and lots, then people refer to the tract of land they own as a parcel. But this language is irrelevant to the sanitary district, and I think that it is a entirely consistent reading of that language in Section 1A of Resolution 9309 that both parcels and lots will be treated as lots for purposes of this resolution only if they're a listed tax parcel number and recorded in the Office of the Register of Deeds.
And each condo did meet that requirement?
That's correct, Your Honor. It's noteworthy to me, Justice Crooks.
Justice Rosser has a question. Oh, I'm sorry. Were you done with Justice?
Just to say that if you look at the legal description that is included with the condominium documents in the statement of the proceedings here, you'll see that what Lot 1 of Certified Survey Map 1409 is a part of Government Lot 1 of Section 8 of this town and range. Things are called lots, were called lots in the 1830s. Names may still be relevant to historians or surveyors, but it doesn't make any difference in the taxation and assessment of real property in modern time.
Okay.
Mr. Justice Prosser?
Suppose, Mr. O'Connor, Sunrise Point had built two identical buildings, and they all started out as apartments. So, Building A, apartments. Building B, apartments. And the apartments in Building A were converted to condominiums. And then the resolution was passed. Would it have been reasonable to have 18 availability charges on Building A and one in B under the resolution? And if so, why?
I think that example, Justice Prosser, highlights the most significant question for the court, which would be that distinction. Happily, there are no apartment buildings that I'm aware of in the sanitary district, so it's a wholly hypothetical example. But there are consequences from the election to own property in the condominium form of ownership. I think it's noteworthy that in Wisconsin and in most of the states follow the same language that appears in Section 70321, which states that once a condominium declaration is filed, that the units are real property and shall be considered parcels for all purposes, including taxation and assessment. Interestingly, in New York State, there's another sentence that follows on there where the New York legislature mandated that the aggregate assessment of all of the condominiums in a particular building may not exceed what that building would have been assessed at if it were not subject to the assessment as individual condominium units. Obviously, that was a legislative, a political decision. Whether such a decision made by the legislature in Wisconsin would pass muster under the uniformity clause is something I won't speculate on, but I think it highlights an obvious point, and that is that a building that has 18 condominiums is worth more if you appraise the 18 condominium units and tally them up than it's worth if what is for sale on the marketplace is an 18-unit apartment building.
Counselor, so you could say the same thing about the mansions that Justice Wilcox was talking about. I don't see how you can relate costs to whether the building itself is a very expensive building, like a mansion would be, or a little teeny two-bedroom cottage.
My point is only that there are financial consequences on owners of property who elect.
That's not what we're looking at here. We're looking at whether your regulation is reasonable.
Counsel, can I? I think our regulation is reasonable because even though it has the consequence of increasing the burden through the assessment on a parcel as a consequence of it being converted to the condominium, being held in the condominium form of ownership.
When I read number 3, sewer service availability assessment, this is what I think Justice Rogensack is talking about. The district shall impose a sewer service availability assessment on property within the sewer service area for costs of work. For costs of work to make sanitary sewer service available to the property. Then it says, each lot assessed under this section shall be provided with a 4-inch lateral pipe. So we're only talking about, that was my, I asked opposing counsel, we're talking about one pipe and the cost of that pipe from the sewer main to the property line or easement line. That's what I was trying to, when you're talking costs, I think we got sidetracked on, you know, how much front footage or whether they're million-dollar mansions, et cetera, but we're talking about one lateral pipe under your assessment under number 3. And the cost of that to each, each lot. And so we're talking about one lateral, and we're talking about one lot here. I mean, Justice Crux talked about at least the lot. So we're only talking about one lateral and one lot. There's not 18 laterals. There's only one.
Well, there's only one instead of 18 because the property owners preferred to have one rather than 18. And there is not one lot, Your Honor, because the definition of lot in Section 1A clearly
Just a minute. I'm not arguing. I'm just stating.
Maybe I'm misunderstanding, Your Honor.
Well, maybe I'm misunderstanding what you're saying. What I'm saying is that under number 3, where it talks about availability and cost, and that's what we're looking at. We're not talking about the value of this, whether it's worth $10 million or $1 million, because everything, whether you said big, little, everyone is to be treated the same. And what I was saying is each lot assessed shall be provided with a 4-inch lateral pipe stub from the main to the property, and it's, what is it for? It's for the cost of the work to make the sanitary sewage service available to that property.
That's correct. And the cost of making sanitary sewer service available to the property is not the construction of the connection stub for their subsequent connection of a lateral. It's a whole series of costs.
Well, there's a connection. I understand that, but we're talking here, just in this lawsuit, about the cost of the laterals, aren't we?
No, the costs of the laterals are strictly private costs paid by the adjacent property.
But assessed by you.
What we're talking about is the cost of building a sewer extension that extends for several miles and serves 210 separate parcels of property with lift stations, electrical provisions, and a whole series of costs. And the availability of assessment ensures that each parcel that construction work makes it possible to provide sewer service to is shared by all of the parcels.
Counsel, I want to get back, part of being the junior justice is you defer to your colleagues, so it's been a while, but I want to get back to you.
Then let me ask this question.
I want to get back to this concept of stubs and condominiums. Now, you argue that in this particular case, there's one stub at the condominium developer's request. In Green Lake, if you know, do the other condominium developments have one stub or multiple stubs for each unit?
I am not aware of another condominium that has been provided with sanitary sewer service by the sanitary district.
Thank you.
Council has emphasized the point in the Peterson case and others about unique fact situations in the analysis of reasonableness. And I just ask the court to focus on the hard job that the local officials have who have to make these calls. Everybody thinks their property is unique. It's unique because it's big, because it's small, because it has such a modest dwelling on it, or for some other reason. But what's unique about this property is the specific manner in which they elected to divide a whole parcel, once called Certified Survey Map Lot 1, into 18 separate parcels of land in accordance with the statutory scheme. They did it in a particular way. That's the only thing that's unique about this. And it shouldn't be a basis for providing a 95% discount on the availability of sewer costs so that burden can be spread more widely to other taxpayers. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. O'Connor. Mr. Russ. Thornton.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Excuse me. Let me begin by clarifying the exhibit that was referred to, which was said that the district or that the petitioners wanted multiple stubs, is a letter that's in the record and was referred to, and I read you that letter. A letter has been sent to all property owners at Sunrise Point asking them if they wanted their lateral. The letter indicates Green Lake Sanitary District will provide one lateral stub per tax parcel. I presume that this is a misstatement as it relates to the members of the condominium association. It is my understanding that it was your intent to only have one lateral stub on the entire project rather than 18 separate stubs. It is not, if that is not the case, contact us. I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but I finish it up. Can we talk about some other things? And finally, it says, my purpose in writing you is clarify three things. One, the contacts will be through me. Two, we don't suppose you mean 18 separate stubs. And three, that Mr. Teske is the contractor, is to contact me. I want it clear on this record today that never, never did this condominium association or any of its members request 18 separate stubs. The record speaks for itself. Let me clarify one other thing that was pointed out. And again, I turn your attention to the record. If you look at the transcript from the court, transcript of the circuit court proceedings, let me have that counsel. I think this clarifies a point that you asked, Justice Butler. Mr. Connor was asked during that proceeding by the
page
court.
Connor.
Page 83, I'm Thank sorry. Judge Robinson. Justice Robinson, excuse me.
Okay.
It says, the court, well, say just you've got an 18 apartment building on a parcel and the sewer came on. How would the sanitary district be assessing that? There would be one availability assessment. It would be substantially identical to the South Shore Homeowners Association. There is one tax parcel, irrespective of the size. There would be 18 connections because there were 18 single-family dwellings. And it goes on to talk about four families. And it goes on to talk about other things. But I think the important thing is here, just we keep forgetting the 55 separate units that are across the road that got one availability charge because there was one single lateral brought to that parcel.
Let me just ask you about those units. Who owned them?
Owned what?
The 55 units.
It's owned by 55 separate property owners as a cooperative.
And who owns the land on which these...
The cooperative owns it. The association, the cooperative association.
And there's only one parcel number.
One corporate, or one cooperative entity, just like any other cooperative. In a co-op, as you understand, it's owned by its members.
Mm-hmm.
It's a system of ownership. Clearly, I want to point out one other thing I think is so relevant.
It's different than a condo.
It's different from a condo on how it's taxed.
Mm-hmm.
And there are different administrative rules. A condo is a fiction. It's a method of owning multiple ownership, just like joint tenancy, tenancy in common. Condominium is a different form of ownership. If you took those 55 units and tomorrow they decided to become a condominium, would they be taxed 55 availability charges?
There'd be 55 parcels. Each one of them would pay their own taxes.
And my point is, I believe that's unreasonable because there's only one lateral servicing that property. I believe if you take the reasonableness standard that Justice Bradley talked about so sincerely in her questions, that's what we're looking at here. I also take you right back to the ordinance itself. And as Justice Wilcox pointed out, the ordinance itself says the assessment rate is based upon a connection at the lot line of a lateral stub. Even though counsel has told you it doesn't say that, that's what it says. It's in the document itself. I would also like to comment on the timeshare question. Under that system, everybody receives a tax bill for their condominium association. Yes, you could easily argue under this logic that there would be multitude, 50 or whatever it is, units that have been sold. Whether they decide to do that as an association or they decide to do that as individual units, every condominium in Wisconsin has that choice. How they are going to handle that as a timeshare condominium. What I'm trying to say is there's also properties on Green Lake. I know of one that just closed yesterday that has 8 different families owning a single property. They have 7 separate bedroom suites. They have 9 bathrooms. It has one lateral. And let me answer the question about other condominiums in Green Lake. There are other condominiums in the city of Green Lake that have one single lateral that received one assessment for their lateral. I know that's not in the record, but Justice Butler, you asked the question.
Same sanitary district?
No. The city of Green Lake has a different sanitary district.
Different rules.
Different rules. But I'm just answering Justice Butler's question. There are no other, but if you also would look at, excuse me, I'm out of time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sorensen. Thank you, Mr. Tesmacher and Mr. O'Connor, for your argument today on assessments for relating to sewers and especially Green Lake Sanitary District. That concludes our hearing in 03-AP-2245. The court is in recess until tomorrow, oral argument, but the court will meet in the conference room at 3:10.